Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Santorum surges. Iran and Israel ramp it up. China's vice president comes to call, and Jeremy Lin's sanity sweeps the NBA. Also, President Obama unveiled a $3.8 trillion budget for 2013 on Monday.
The economy is growing stronger. The recovery is speeding up. And the last thing we can afford to do right now is to go back to the very policies that got us into this mess in the first place. We can't afford it.
GOP presidential candidate Rick Santorum rides a streak of success. He spoke yesterday at an economic forum in Detroit.
There is income inequality in America. There always has been. And hopefully, and I do say that, there always will be. Why? Because people rise to different levels of success based on what they contribute to society and to the marketplace. And that's as it should be.
And high tension between Iran and Israel. Sylvain Shalom, Israel's deputy prime minister, said Iran is looking to again become a major superpower.
They would like to revive the Persian Empire. They would like to change the types of the regimes in the Middle East. They would like to take control of the all oil fields within the Middle East and to have a nuclear bomb.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Trudy Rubin of the Philadelphia Inquirer, Reed Wilson of the National Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Can you see why Rick Santorum is rising to the top? Are you breathing a sigh of relief with deals on the payroll tax and unemployment? What's your top story of the week? Comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. From Washington, we're joined by Reed Wilson. He's editor-in-chief of the National Journal Hotline, a daily tip sheet on campaigns and elections. And Reed Wilson, welcome to the show. Great to have you.
Hey, Anthony. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And from Philadelphia, we're joined by Trudy Rubin, worldview columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy Rubin, welcome back to On Point. Good to have you.
Thanks, Anthony.
And as always, from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Anthony, Trudy, and Reed.
Well, everybody, let's start with the fight for the Republican presidential nomination. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney finds himself facing his biggest challenge yet. In spite of big advantages with money and organization, former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum is giving him a real run for his money. He swept a trio of primaries and caucuses a couple of weeks ago. He now leads Romney in both national polls and perhaps really surprising, a recent survey out of Michigan, which is one of Romney's home states, which votes at the end of this month. So let me start with you, Reed Wilson. What explains the Santorum surge?
Well, Republicans are still looking for the right candidate. They're still not happy with the primary field as it is. And Rick Santorum is sort of the blank slate onto which they are projecting their emotions. And at the moment, their emotions are largely anti-Mitt Romney. The entire race has been characterized by a search for the candidate who's not Mitt Romney. Rick Perry filled those shoes for a while. Michelle Bachmann did. Herman Cain did. Newt Gingrich did for a brief time. Santorum is the latest to do so. And he's sort of the blank slate that Romney has not defined yet, that nobody else has sort of made a negative out of yet. So because he's winning, he's got this momentum behind him, and he is at least more conservative and more believably conservative than Romney is. Romney's biggest problem through this whole time has been a sort of an authenticity gap with Republican candidates, with Republican conservatives, rather. Last weekend, we heard him talk at CPAC about how he was severely conservative. A lot of my conservative friends around Washington, D.C. sort of pounded their head against the wall and saying, you know, who actually says that? That's not exactly the sort of language you use when talking about conservatism. Mm. So at the end of the day, his authenticity problem has always been a big deal. Rick Santorum is much more authentic.
See, I want to ask Trudy Rubin, you're in Philadelphia, and I want to ask you, what's the buzz around Santorum? Because what Reed says, I really agree with. When I got a glimpse of both of these folks up in New Hampshire, I was struck by, regardless of what you feel about his politics, there is something authentic about Rick Santorum, and that seems to be carrying the day right now versus Romney.
Well, he certainly has a warmer, fuzzier personality, although the idea of a presidential election being waged over issues like birth control, I'm sure has some sober Republicans worrying a bit. One of the stories that interested me the most this week was about how Romney cannot connect with conservative pundits. And I think that is Romney's problem. He can't connect with the public, and he can't even connect with the writers, people like Ann Coulter, who embraced him early on and is now worried because he hasn't even sought her out or made nice to her. So if we're talking about personalities, then Santorum clearly has the edge. But when people start looking at his policies, I think there will be a lot more question marks.
Jack Beatty, you agree with that. And tell me, Jack, you know, what does this say about the Republican race and where it's headed?
Well, I think it's as Reed says, people have been looking for an alternative to Mitt Romney. And the problem for Mitt Romney right now is he can't really say the truth about Rick Santorum. He can't turn to Michigan voters and say, look, this fellow does represent your convictions at some level or other. According to one poll, 39% of voters in the Michigan GOP primary in 2008 were either evangelicals or born again. So he can say, you know, he does represent what you think about moral issues, but that's not electable. He would effectively, I'm now putting the argument in Mitt Romney's mouth about Rick Santorum, he would effectively be running not only against a Democrat, but against American culture and society. You cannot run as a presidential candidate in America today, Mitt Romney could say, making comments like, I will speak about, quote, the dangers of contraception in this country. You can't run as a presidential candidate saying he wants to abolish federal aid to education. He wants the states to stop aiding education. His ideal seems to be something like his own family for the whole country. His own family, seven children, his wife stayed home and educated them. And he seems to be proposing that, Mitt Romney could say, for the country. And folks, he could say finally, that simply is not, can't work in this country.
Well, let's listen to a cut of tape. This is Foster Freeze, Rick Santorum's super PAC benefactor, speaking yesterday to MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell, saying essentially that contraception isn't necessary if people practice abstinence. Let's listen.
This contraceptive thing, my gosh, it's such inexpensive. You know, back in my days, they used bear aspirin for contraceptives. The gals put it between their knees, and it wasn't that costly.
So that's Foster Freeze on MSNBC yesterday. He was making the point that there were other things, jobs, terrorism to focus on, but he stoked the fire of the culture wars that are rising this campaign season. Reed, do comments like that help or hurt Rick Santorum?
No, that's why you don't put non-trained, you know, untrained surrogates on MSNBC or something like that. Those comments are not going to do anything for Rick Santorum's campaign. The interesting thing, I think, between the Romney and Santorum, what sort of this Romney-Santorum battle tells us about the larger Republican Party as it is this has really turned into a class race. It's much more about Mitt Romney representing sort of the larger business interests in the Republican Party, Rick Santorum representing the more activist, more socially conservative roots of the Republican Party. And right now, that more socially active, socially conservative group is winning. And I think they were the people who fueled the Tea Party momentum in 2010. They're the people who have really striven to kick President Obama out. And at the moment, they're the ones in charge of the Republican nominating process. That is not good news for Mitt Romney.
Mm. Well, let me ask about that. One more question about this before we move on to many of the other stories that we want to focus on this morning. But what can Mitt Romney do to right himself? You know, he took care of Newt Gingrich in Florida with a slew of negative advertising. Arguably, though, that took him off message, maybe even damaged his campaign a bit. Trudy Rubin, what's your take on that?
Well, I think this is what candidates in trouble always have the hardest thing doing. Can they change their personality? Clearly, if Mitt Romney could somehow become more humanized, reach out to people, reach out at least to the media in his own corner, it would make a huge difference. But personality changes are hard to do. As we know, people have advised President Obama for the whole of his presidency to be warmer, more fuzzy. It's not who he is. And so it's hard to see Mitt Romney somehow becoming a different personality than he's shown us.
Yeah, Jack Beatty, he's certainly not going to become a different personality. Is his money and his organization and just sort of the slow and steady as she goes, is that going to carry the day for him? Or does he have to get serious about an adjustment here?
Well, what adjustment could it be, I wonder, for the reasons Trudy said. And as you suggested, Anthony, his spending is a double-edged sword. Yes, he won by blitzing. 98% of his ads in Florida were negative against Newt. He could do that again in Michigan. But, of course, while he's been losing among the GOP base, the more blue-collar base, he's also been losing dramatically among independents who are going to be crucial in the November election. And why? Well, analysts think because of this totally negative blitz he's put on. This is exactly the kind of thing that alienates independents. So he's trapped. I mean, if he tries to smash Santorum with or his super PAC does, it could backfire on him either in this campaign or certainly in the fall. And moreover, Santorum is a tougher candidate. He has issue positions such as that are really outside the mainstream, such as on contraception and so on. But to attack those is to attack the conviction of many people in the GOP base. So, and he doesn't have the other kind of baggage that Newt Gingrich has.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're discussing this week's top stories. We've got a great panel with us. Reed Wilson of National Journal, Trudy Rubin of the Philly Inquirer, and our own Jack Beatty. They're all here today. And folks, let's talk about President Obama's budget. This week, he urged Congress to pass a $3.8 billion budget for the coming fiscal year. The president proposes to raise new taxes on the very wealthy, restructure the tax code, $3.8 trillion. He's also proposing to restructure the tax code and new short-term spending to boost job growth. And here's Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who took to the Senate floor on Monday to say that that President Obama has broken his promise to reduce the federal deficit.
3 years ago, President Obama promised to cut the federal deficit in half by the end of his first term. He hasn't even come close. And here he is once again proposing the same failed policies that have prolonged this economic crisis well into the president's fourth year in office.
So no surprise, Republicans in Congress pretty much dismissed the plan. Mitch McConnell there later referred to that as nothing more than a campaign document. Let me start with you, Reed. What do you see? What do you see in this budget proposal and the looming or continuing fight with Republicans over it?
Well, it is an incredibly political document. I mean, everything about it is sort of the marker from which President Obama will run for re-election. He's proposed to raise taxes on the wealthy. He's proposed to give more tax cuts to the working class. I mean, this is the starting point for the discussion that he gets to make with gets to have with independent voters in the fall. No president's budget is ever rubber stamped in Congress. Even members of their own party will change it. So it's not like this is anything terribly unusual. Folks from both sides have done that. But, this is an interesting document also, by the way, in that it brings out two interesting points. First of all, the growth projections that the White House uses are much more optimistic than I think just about any economist would have. They project revenues growing at in the trillions of dollars when that may not in fact be the case down the road. The other thing, though, is, by the way, there was a small little footnote. It said we might have yet another debt ceiling fight on our hands.
Oh, boy.
One of the footnotes a couple hundred pages into the thousands of pages long document suggested that the U.S., because of this payroll payroll tax extension, which is going to add about $100 billion to the deficit, that the U.S. could be running up on their on the deficit limit, the debt ceiling limit, by the end of September. Well, that's about a month before Election Day, which is going to cause yet another fight here in Washington, D.C., right as people are about to go out and hit the campaign trail.
Jack Beatty, Reid was talking about this as sort of suggesting early on there that this is sort of a blueprint, in a sense, for the sort of political fight that's coming. I'm wondering how you view this proposed budget.
Well, I think that's right, in that it doesn't have a chance of passing. But as a statement of national priorities, there's much in it to admire, I think, frankly. He proposes $2.50 in spending cuts for every dollar in taxes, $2.50 in spending cuts. Now, we heard all Republican candidates say that they would not accept a 10-to-1 ratio. That is, if taxes went up $1, they wouldn't accept $10 in cuts in spending. So that's a clear difference with the Republicans. The taxes on the affluent there contrast sharply with what the Republicans are offering. For example, Rick Santorum, who wants to eliminate the estate tax entirely. And then spending cuts. It preserves important spending on infrastructure, on education. There's an $8 billion provision in there to help community colleges articulate their programs with businesses. There's more money for research. In short, the things that produce a prosperous economy in the future. That contrasts with Rick Santorum again yesterday. He says he wants to cut $1 trillion in spending every year for the next 5 years. That would wipe out all of that sort of investment in the future economy. So it's quite a stark contrast with what the Republicans are offering.
Yeah, and speaking of contrast with what the Republicans want, I know in that budget he's proposing to replace the alternative minimum tax, which has begun to snare some middle-class taxpayers as well, with the so-called Buffett rule, right? A 30% tax on Americans who earn more than $1 million a year. That could be a pretty strong case to bring against Mitt Romney, who we know is somewhere in the 13-14% tax bracket. What do you think? What do you think, Reid Wilson?
That's exactly right. Look, Mitt Romney has done nothing but provide President Obama with more opportunities to go after him if he is indeed the eventual Republican nominee. He is the 1% of the 1%. I think that we're going to see a lot of talk about how he keeps his money, how he spends his money, and the fact that he is in that top tax bracket. President Obama has set out these very clear guidelines that he wants to fight this campaign as a measure between, or a contest rather, between those who make a lot of money and those who don't make so much money, the middle class and the upper class. That's sort of going to be the dominant part of the conversation. Romney's wealth only helps drive home that point.
Mm. Let's take a caller. Jerry is calling from Mason City, Iowa. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Anthony. Yes, I wanted to make a comment about this payroll tax cut. I think it's another example of where we have our Congress that is just, there's an issue out there, but they keep kicking this can down the road. They fiddle while Rome burns. It adds another $100 billion to the deficit and whatnot. And, you know, they say it's bad for the middle class and the lower class, but who pays for Social Security? It should be the people that are eventually going to get those benefits. And, yes, it sounds good. We're cutting taxes now, but that's still more money that's not in that system. So later on, they will have to cut it back even more to keep it solvent.
Well, Jerry, it's a good point. I mean, the budget, the budget projects that the deficit will exceed $1 trillion for the fourth straight year, which means Obama won't meet his promise to cut the deficit in half by the end of his first term. Trudy Rubin, do you see that as something, you know, a powerful issue that the Republicans could use against him?
We're in an election year, and I think the voiceover that you played from Obama at the beginning of the show says it all. Basically, if unemployment keeps going down, if the economic figures look a little bit brighter, Obama will campaign on the slogan, "Do you want to go back to the policies that brought us to the crisis of the past few years?" And if he can show that things are getting better, then he will get through this election year, and presumably he will have to face this budget crisis in spades if and when he's reelected. So I think, you know, that is probably what is on his mind and his team's mind.
Well, it's interesting. You say, you mentioned his polling numbers and his position. They're up somewhat, seems to be in a position of a little more strength when it comes to waging this debate. So we'll see where this goes. But let's move on to some other big news this week, and specifically some news from overseas. China's Vice President Xi Jinping wraps up a 5-day trip to the U.S. today after stops in Washington, D.C. and Muscatine, Illinois. He's in Los Angeles today for business talks, and Xi Jinping is widely expected to be China's leader in 2013. Earlier this week, he received a red carpet welcome, a 19-gun salute, and an Oval Office meeting with President Obama. Trudy, what's the purpose of this visit? Was it to introduce China's heir apparent to the U.S.?
It was a getting acquainted trip. And I think one of the most fascinating element of it was his visit to Muscatine, Iowa, where he visited on an exchange a couple of decades ago. And the thing that's so fascinating to me about that is that it was to make him look down home, to make him look like a friend to the United States. But it also has an interesting link with the situation back in China, where peasants around the country are rising up because their land is being taken for development and protests are being held. And it sort of raises questions about whether Vice President Xi, if and when he takes over, is going to be the reformer that perhaps speaks to the grievances of peasants, or whether he's going to continue along the lines of the current leadership that cracks down on all such dissent. And what adds to this interesting question is that his father, who was a friend of Mao Zedong but then was purged, was thought of as liberal. So when I saw him visiting farmers in Muscatine, it not only raised the question of his relationship to the United States, but the issue of how he will face the big political reform question in China in the future.
Fascinating. And, of course, big differences between Washington and Beijing, not the least of which a growing trade deficit that favors China, differences over Syria, Iran, North Korea, and human rights. Let's listen to Vice President Joe Biden briefing the press after morning talks in Washington with Vice President Xi.
We spent a great deal of time discussing the areas of our greatest concern, including the need to rebalance the global economy, to protect intellectual property rights and trade secrets, to address China's undervalued exchange rate, to level the competitive playing field, to prevent the forced transfer of technology, and to continue a constructive dialogue on policies that would benefit our citizens and the world.
So that's Vice President Joe Biden talking about his meeting with Vice President Xi of China. Jack Beatty, it's not often that a vice president gets this kind of welcome, but there's a lot at stake. What struck you this week about Xi Jinping's visit to Washington and how the Obama administration is responding?
Well, what strikes me is this cybersecurity issue. We did a whole show on it yesterday, and we had an expert say that China's economic model depends upon theft, the theft of other people's secrets, wholesale, as part of their that's part of their growth strategy. That's how they're one of the ways they're trying to deal with that peasant problem and agriculture problem that Trudy was talking about. They want to keep this growth rate going, and the only way they can do that is to keep pirating, keep stealing other people's industrial secrets. And of course, what that does is it essentially steals the American future. Now, we have a cybersecurity bill apparently somewhere in the Congress, But the newly empowered Silicon Valley, you know, web lobby is saying, oh, we can't have that. We can't have any interference with any sort of regulation of cybersecurity. And you just have to wonder, is the Chinese could pay for that lobbying. I mean, it's exactly what they want. They want to keep our system porous so they can steal away our secrets. And I was talking to the expert we had on a show afterwards, and he was saying, you know, whole American industries could disappear given to this Chinese program.
Reed Wilson, I'd like to come back to you. You've got your eyes on sort of the Washington scene. How did this visit play out in Washington, in your view?
Well, I think this has been a fascinating example of sort of the challenges and opportunities that China is providing to both parties as they look forward to governing in the foreseeable future. On one hand, you know, China has been one of President Obama's big foreign policy successes. There's a great cover story in this month's issue of The Atlantic by James Fallows that takes a look at really just how effectively the Obama administration has, on one hand, courted China and made a point to say that they agree with or they welcome China's rise in the world and China's increased role. And on the other hand, they've sort of outmaneuvered them as China has irritated a number of nations in the Pacific Rim. The U.S. has gone in with sort of soft power to win back a lot of influence on that side. But what the clip you just played from Joe Biden, we're hearing talk about the tough stands that the administration has to take. Americans are worried about the growth of China. And so any administration is going to have to play up the concerns that they leveled, the concerns that they took to the Chinese. That being said, China has played the role of the boogeyman on the campaign trail. Last week, during the Super Bowl, a Senate candidate in Michigan played an advertisement that really sort of played to the worst stereotypes of Asian people, and had a woman who was speaking in broken English that sounded to a lot of people like race baiting a bit. So China always plays the bad guy on the campaign trail. But in reality, the way either party is going to have to approach China is a very nuanced it's got to be a very nuanced approach, as the Obama administration has shown.
Yeah. And Trudy, let me come back to you. I mean, in terms of how to engage China going forward on some of these issues and pick up where some of the issues that Jack was talking about with cybersecurity or the challenges that Reed was laying out. What do you think?
Look, I think there are other challenges as well. I mean, right now, one of the things that the administration is focusing on is trying to get to China to rethink its position both on Syria in terms of vetoing the Arab League resolution that would have called for Assad to step down in favor of a vice president and have a peaceful transition. And the administration is also trying to persuade China to rethink its position on Iran. And China is trying to lower its energy dependency on Iran. China is the largest purchaser of Iranian oil exports, and it is now buying more from Saudi Arabia. But so far, China is very afraid of endorsing anything that smells of regime change. However, I think this is an area where the administration might be able to make some progress, since China is also worried about instability in the Middle East and about the rise of Islamism, because they have a radical problem in their western region with radical Islamists. So I think there's going to be a lot of work behind the scenes on trying to find joint foreign policy positions, while on issues like cybersecurity, it's just going to be back and forth, back and forth. But I think the thinking in the Obama administration is you have to work it and work it and work it, because they change slowly. But Obama has made it clear Asia is going to be the big focus if he's reelected. And, you know, I think they just think they can work this slower.
I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking about this week's top stories. And here's some other news from the week. Jeremy Lin, New York Knicks point guard, goes from bench warmer to savior. In Toronto on Tuesday, he sunk a three-pointer with a half a second on the clock to win it for the Knicks.
Fans on their feet. Five, four, Lynn for the win! Got it!
Oh, yeah, he got it. 25-year-old Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, who tried and failed to blow up a plane with an underwear bomb, received multiple life sentences in prison. Here's U.S. Assistant District Attorney Jonathan Tuckle.
We ended up with the same result that we think we would have had at the end, so, justice was well served.
And singer Whitney Houston died over the weekend at 48 years old. Her private funeral this Saturday will be live streamed on the internet.
And I will always love you. I will always...
And that's the great voice of Whitney Houston. Those are some of the stories making news this week. Joining us is Reed Wilson. He's editor-in-chief of National Journal Hotline. And Reed, thanks for joining us as always. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, Anthony.
Also with us is Trudy Rubin. She's worldview columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Trudy, it's always great to have you as well.
Thanks very much, Anthony.
And of course, Jack Beatty's with us. So let's move on to another big foreign news story this week, starting with Iran. There seems to be two messages coming out of Iran this week. One, defiance. President Ahmadinejad announced that Iran had new centrifuges able to enrich uranium more quickly, saying the arrogant powers cannot monopolize nuclear technology. The other message, though, the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton confirmed this week that a top Iranian official expressed a willingness to reopen negotiation on its nuclear program. Trudy, sort this out for us. Where are we this week in terms of Iran, its nuclear program, its showdown with the West?
Well, I think we're at the point where the United States has to decide what do we want when a policy is succeeding, and the Iranians have to decide what do they want when their policy is up against a wall. In fact, crippling sanctions are having an effect on Iran, and the sanctions are only going to get worse because, as of July, the Europeans, who are the second largest importer of Iranian oil after China, are going to stop buying it. And also, the global electronic banking system known as SWIFT, the Europeans are thinking about and probably will exclude key Iranian banks from this system, which means that they won't be able to move money. So the Iranians are in a pickle. Their currency is plummeting against Western currencies. And so they are making this gesture, which so far doesn't amount to anything. The problem is that if the Iranians feel squeezed now, and if they did feel they had to go back to talk seriously, which we don't know that that's the case yet, would we really have an agenda where we might be able to force them into something reasonable, or are we now stuck on a course where we would want them to give up every bit of enrichment capability, which they probably wouldn't do, and then we would be left with this possibility of having to go in and do a military strike, which has all kinds of repercussions for the whole region. The Senate just introduced a resolution with 32 senators bipartisan signing on. I think there's going to be an attempt to corral Obama. And the resolution calls for no containment and not allowing Iran to have any capacity. The real issue is Iran is a signatory to the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They're allowed to enrich if they are closely watched. But if we are going to insist on no enrichment, we may be trapped in going into a situation where we have no choice but to go towards military action. And so I think we're at a crossroads now.
A real crossroads. And Jack Beatty, let me draw you into this conversation. What about Israel and talk of an attack? This week, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told the Israeli parliament, "These days, Iran's acts of terror are clear to everyone." He was referring to bombings in Thailand, India, and Georgia, allegedly linked to Iran. What's your take on this situation?
Well, there was an excellent report in Salon this week by Larry Durfner, a correspondent in Israel. The headline says it all: Israelis prepare for war with Iran. and the underline, even ex-Mossad chief who opposed an attack seems to have given up. And he shows how across the board, with the exception of just the most liberal elements in the press, the press is uniformly saying, no, we have to face up to this. And there's been and the Israelis have had a policy really for decades that no Arab state is going to get a nuclear weapon. They struck at Iran in 1981 over this. They struck at Syria in 2007 at a reactor. And they're preparing, according to this, now to strike at Iran. Leon Panetta, leaked to the Washington Post a week ago, saying, you know, this could happen as early as April. And meanwhile, the Obama administration, according to this report, has been muted in the restraint it's been trying to put on the Israelis, partly because how strong an argument could they really make, the Obama administration, when they've been repeating now for years that it's unacceptable for Iran to have nuclear weapons and that all options are on the table. So you get the feeling that the administration is not being as energetic. I mean, Secretary Panetta is clear. This is not in the United States' interest. He has said it is not even in Israel's interest, according to David Ignatius. And yet they're apparently not willing or not able to really convince the Israelis, we don't want you to do this. Now, of course, Congress is so...
Trudy, try him in here, because you wrote last week that Defense Secretary Leon Panetta was worried that Israel could attack this spring. Is that a growing possibility?
They are worried, but I think they are being quite energetic. First of all, in talks, I was in Israel in the fall and November when this was a big issue. I've talked with a lot of Israeli security experts, including former heads of whatever. And the Israelis really do not want to do it alone, because what they know is that they don't have the capacity to do more than to delay the Iranian program a couple of years. And the cost of that would be extremely high. And that is why the former head of the Mossad, Meir Dagan, has spoken out publicly, as have other former heads of Israeli security agencies, saying that they could postpone the program by covert means, as is happening now with the assassination of Iranian scientists, which is why there's probably this tit-for-tat going on with attacks on Israeli diplomats. So there is a reluctance in Israel, and part of the whole public storm and drang in Israel is to put pressure on the Americans, either to do it for the Israelis, which President Obama is not ready to do, or to back up Israel. But the United States has also made it pretty clear, and Panetta said some things publicly that were quite surprising, that should Israel go it alone, America's main concern will be protecting our interests in the region, and we are not going to come in behind Israel. The tricky wicket here is that if Israel does it alone, we might be dragged in if the Iranians responded in any way, say, against U.S. ships in the Gulf. But I think the Obama administration has been trying very hard and has been showing by action that crippling sanctions have been put in place. The reason we're at a crossroads now is if crippling sanctions do push Iran to put forward a serious negotiating proposal, there you have a crisis with Israel, because I think Israel does not want negotiations to start again. They feel this would give Iran some breathing room. So there is always the possibility that Israel would do it alone, but I think the Obama administration has made very clear the limits on our help in this case, and that Israel is reluctant to do it alone and is trying to push the U.S. to back them.
Well, Trudy Rubin, stand by, and Reed Wilson, Jack Peedy. I want to get a caller into this conversation. Maria is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Anthony. I just wanted to, first I was going to say something else, but the speakers have convinced me to modify my stance. I don't think negotiations will work because Iran has never been serious about negotiations before. I think they're just trying to buy time. I don't know if the crippling sanctions will work or if that'll drive Mahmoud Ahmadinejad into a sort of Hitler-esque bunker mentality, you know, just self-destruction and damned be the consequences. I'm not sure Israel will wait for us. They've never allowed nuclear power to be developed by any Arab country, and I'm not sure that they'll wait. I'm not sure they'll feel like they will be able to wait. And I think it's a real mistake to engage in negotiations at this point because they've never been serious. All they do is buy time, and it will be impossible to tell whether they're serious or not. And so I think the strikes will go forward in April, and we'll get dragged into it by whatever Iran does in the Straits of Hormuz.
Well, Maria, thanks for that call. Reed Wilson, let me bring you into this conversation. There's Maria from Iowa City saying that talks are futile. I wanted to raise this interesting editorial from Dennis Ross, former diplomat, who wrote in the New York Times this week. Before we assume that diplomacy can't work, it's worth considering that Iranians are now facing crippling pressure, notwithstanding all their bluster. There are signs that Tehran is now looking for a way out. Does that sound right to you?
One of the very interesting things that I always watch about these international crises that we seem to careen from one to another is that the way their internal politics are working. And Iran's internal politics are hugely more complex than most other countries in the world. There are all these different councils and governing bodies that have to interact with each other on various matters. And President Ahmadinejad is not the be-all and end-all of Iranian government. As a matter of fact, neither is the Ayatollah in Iran. So they all have these checks and balances on each other that are huge. Add these hugely complex layers to the internal Iranian debate, and a big part of that is how the sanctions actually are impacting Iran. I thought one of the most interesting things over the last few weeks was their threats to close the Strait of Hormuz. That, by the way, very much falls into the category of within American interests, and we have sent to carrier groups into the area to sort of make it known that that's not going to be acceptable. So that sounded like a little bit more of an aggressive stand than we've seen from Iran lately. Maybe that's because they are backed into a corner.
Let's move on from Iran to Syria. According to the United Nations, more than 7,400 people have died in 11 months of uprising in Syria. They passed a non-binding resolution, the UN did yesterday, that further isolates Syria and its backer and calls for President Assad to step down. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee also passed a resolution yesterday condemning the violence in Syria. Trudy, what should the U.S. and the West do about the situation in Syria? What's left to do, I guess I should ask?
Right. This is one of these situations, like many in the Middle East, where there are no good options. There are already some weapons flowing into the Syrian opposition. The question is whether we or Europe or whoever, Turkey, should provide more and provide more training. The problem is that everyone knows that weapons alone won't do it because the deserters in the Syrian army are only a few thousand in number. They're not well trained, and they're up against a very highly trained professional army whose officer corps and special units are loyal to Assad because they're members of his minority Alawite sect, which is Shiite. The problem here is that nobody wants to do another Libya. For understandable reasons, Syria is not Libya. If you were going to bomb across Syria, you would kill hundreds if not thousands of civilians, and you don't have large expanses of desert. And remember that in Libya, it took 6 months, a small country with a much weaker Gaddafi.
Yeah.
So the main thing, I think, right now is to convince Russia to abandon its ally, because Russia, in the end, is going to be on the wrong side and lose their port facilities and have repercussions that will hurt them if they don't try to encourage a peaceful transition. I think that's what's being worked on now. More arms will flow to the rebels, but that's not going to create a quick victory.
Well, while we're in Syria, I want to make this sad note. Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent Anthony Shadid died in Syria yesterday from an asthma attack. For almost two decades, Shadid covered the Middle East for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe. He was a friend and a frequent guest of our show. Last April, he talked to Tom Ashbrook about being taken captive in Libya, and he had this to say to a caller about the risks of his work.
I've made some tough calls in the past. In 2003, I decided to stay in Baghdad. unembedded during the American invasion. I took risks in 2006 when I covered the war between Israel and Lebanon. There have been other moments where, you know, I felt that if I wasn't there, the story wouldn't be told otherwise. And I think that, I tell that to myself because I think it's the most altruistic reading of it. You know, if I'm not there, the story won't be told.
That's reporter Anthony Shadid, who died in Syria yesterday from an asthma attack. Trudy Reed, I know you knew Anthony Shadid. We have only about a minute left, but I'd like to get a comment from a couple of you, your memories.
Anthony Shadid was so unassuming. He was such a quiet personality, and yet you knew that this was the person who risked everything to tell the stories of ordinary correspondents. He was the ultimate foreign correspondent, the kind of whom there were very few left who spoke the language. It would be hard to replace him.
Jack Beatty, it's just a reminder. I know he died of asthma, which wasn't necessarily related to the risks he was taking over there. Still, he died on his job reporting from overseas. It's just a reminder of the kind of sacrifices this work requires, right?
Certainly. And he had, in fact, been shot once and, of course, taken prisoner taken hostage in Libya and roughed up there. One sympathy really goes out to his family and friends. And just reading about him, the note that Trudy strikes really sounds the right one. His extraordinary empathy for just ordinary people in these countries and his commitment to tell their stories. That really will be missed.
Well, again, Anthony Shadid died in Syria yesterday from an asthma attack. As Jack Beatty says, our sympathies to his family. And that's it for today. Reed Wilson, editor-in-chief of National Journal Hotline. Reed, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciated having you.
Thanks again, Anthony.
And Trudy Rubin, worldview columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Always great to have you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And as always, Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Anthony.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.